welcome to The Parent Equation with me, Aisha Murray. I'm a coach and I primarily support working parents and carers who believe that parenthood shouldn't be a barrier to a successful and fulfilling career. In this podcast series, I chat to inspirational working parents and ask them to share their own experiences of raising children alongside their careers. We talk about the struggles and the moments of joy. And I hope in each episode, there's something that can bring you a bit more strength and positivity. So please follow, listen, and subscribe on all major platforms. So good morning, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Parent Equation. Today, I am joined by Nathan McGurl. Nathan is the founder of The Study Buddy and father of two older children. So I'm hoping that he has some insights from being the parent of older children to share with me today. So welcome, Nathan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So maybe if we kick off with, I think, because I've just mentioned the study buddy and people are probably thinking, what is that? Maybe let's start with that. So if you could give us a little synopsis of what that is and who it's aimed at, that'd be great.
Oh, with pleasure. So the study buddy originally was a way in which I could help my son to structure his time when it came to the GCSE exams that he was facing, because unfortunately he wasn't really able to structure his time when left to his own devices, which isn't uncommon in teens. And so we went through the usual gambit of bribery and shouting. None of this was particularly effective. And so what I did was applied sort of a light quasi agile project management approach to what he had to do. And it worked out to be successful. Shared the idea with other parents in his class and friends, and I suppose the way that you usually do when you come up with an idea like this. More and more people started to ask about it, friends of friends. And so thought, well, maybe there's something in this. Maybe there's a platform that I could help talk about the approach and the system and help other parents and students, because all of us, no matter who it is you talk to, whether it's someone who's got dozens of children or whether they've got one, everyone just wants their children to fulfill their potential. So the study buddy was born as an idea to sort of help with that system. And we've got products like timetables and schedules and that really help to get families up and running quickly. And then during the lockdown, we've also applied some of that thinking to the busy parents who are now juggling teacher assistant and classroom duties alongside the washing and also the day job. It was an interesting journey to creating it.
And is it a new funky app based tech product, or is it a more tangible in your hands product?
So this is very old school and unapologetically old school. And I say that as a self-confessed nerd. My entire career has been based on digital and social and new media, as we used to call it back in the olden days. So there is an app part to it, or that sits alongside it for those who want it. But it is absolutely about being present. It's a physical product that you can see and move magnets around so that you can schedule time. And there's real power, I think, in that, the sheer visibility of this thing, it's the children know what they're doing, and actually young kids love it. Whether or not it's a novelty factor for them that they actually get to use their hand and write something, or whether it's the fact that they can get involved, but moving the magnets around, seeing something going that you need to do, and then you're scheduling it, and then once it's done, you move it into a done pile. It's very much like the old inbox and outbox idea that you would have. And there's so much satisfaction that comes from a job done, ticking something off of a to-do list, or, as I say, seeing your inbox go down and your the outbox go out, go up, in the days when we used to post lots of stuff.
Those were the days.
I'm really conscious that I'm making myself sound antiquated. It's a physical thing. It's about sort of getting involved and doing stuff with it. Problem with the digital, for all of its wonder and splendor and and mystery. The biggest problem is you can just ignore it.
Yeah.
If you've got an app and it tells you now's the time to study your GCSE maths algebra, you could just swipe. Or once you're there, you think, oh, no, I'll do that after I've checked looked at something else. Latest TikTok phenomena.
Yeah.
Or that kind of thing. So it's about finding something that was novel, but also, frankly, works for parents. I mean, I am old school, so actually that's the kind of thing we're used to.
Yeah, but also to your point about it, if it was an app and it was part of a multitude of apps and distractions on a phone, it just becomes wallpaper, it just becomes absorbed by that technology, doesn't it? Whereas having something tangible that you can see all the time, as you say, get involved physically with it to move things around. I mean, something that I would definitely use in my coaching generally is get things out on paper. Don't type everything all the time. For journaling or reflecting on a problem or a challenge, get a piece of paper and a pencil and a pen and write it down and mind map things and get it to a state where you can see it. You can see it all in front of you. Whereas, as you say, if it's digital, you don't need to see it, or you can close it down, or it disappears behind another window or TikTok,
exactly.
Which you can't be antiquated if you're talking about TikTok, but TikTok appears. So I think that's, I can really see the value in something practical and tangible for you to get your hands on.
Yeah.
And then do you think parents, from your experience with this product being out there, are parents saying that it's helping with that feeling of overwhelm that teenagers inevitably have during this period?
Absolutely. Mm. And during this period and any other period as well, actually, to be honest, because I think although these are exceptional circumstances, obviously, and teens find themselves in completely unenviable positions of not being able to see their friends, which we know the teenage brain needs, and being cooped up in the house with their parents, which we know teenagers and parents do not need. And then also they've got the exam pressures. They have also got this extra bit of what's going on. And so I think it's exceptional, but exceptional for that reason, but not uncommon for teens to feel stress in the approach to exams. And so we've seen that in previous years when there were exams, that children and young people like to have that sort of sense of control, which really comes from only knowing what have I got to do and when have I got to do it. How much have I done? So without that, things can spiral. And I think it's human nature, and certainly in my experience, in the nature of teens, to assume the worst. So I've either got loads to do, there's just no sense in even trying.
Yep.
Or I've got loads to do, let's panic, I need to spend all night doing it. Mm. And neither of those are happy positions to be in, obviously. Mm. And it's interesting, actually, because it was created for a procrastinating boy. And I do think, although girls are equally as capable of procrastinating, it does tend to be a bit of a gender stereotype. But there's also, that comes wrapped up with this idea, I think, within the male bravado, teen male bravado especially, that if I don't really try, I haven't really failed. And so they can be overwhelmed underneath the surface, and on top they're going to look like they just completely don't give a monkey's about anything that's happening. Mm. And it is that whole idea of ego, I think, of looking like, I don't really care. But then, of course, when they get the results, of course they're going to care, because this is an awful age to be making huge life decisions.
Mm. So how does it work? I'm not a parent of teenagers yet. I'm not quite there. And I understand, obviously, at the moment, the exam turmoil, where exams aren't happening and there are different assessments and things going on. So presumably this way of working, sort of using this agile methodology, if you like, can work not only for a sort of finite exam period, but could work more of a long-term assessment type approach, could it?
Absolutely. And that's the oddity, I think, with the GCSEs and the A levels, is that the build-up is for the exams. So you'd almost think that the exams are what you're working towards.
Yeah.
And it's weird because we're so used to this situation. But in actual fact, it's not about the exams. It's about the course content. And the exam is an indication of how much of that course content you know. Now, that could sound like semantics. Mm. And ordinarily, it probably would be. But for the last 2 years, when we haven't had exams, how do you know what you're capable of doing? Which is where we've ended up with this horrible situation over teacher assessments and algorithms and spreadsheets and everything else. Yeah. Because I think we've lost sight of what's the important bit. And the important bit was the knowledge, was the acquisition of skills and of knowledge, of learning your way through a course. The grade was almost, the exam, terminal exam was almost by the by. And we've seen that in the past. So certainly when I was at school, we would have a mix of coursework and exam, which would show you how you go through. I think, as I remember, my English literature GCSE, they were GCSEs. I think I was in the first.
We both were in the first year, I think.
First couple of years.
We're the same age, which we found out. And I think our year was the first one to do GCSEs. So we just scraped in past the O-level.
We did. And I don't think anyone, I'm not sure if this goes out on video as well, no one will believe we're the same.
Oh, of course not.
Absolutely.
It doesn't go out on video, but maybe it should just for this episode.
I think just a photo next to it. Believe it or not. So because we did the English literature the English literature GCSE in those early days, I think it was all coursework. So this sort of mixed economy of how you can gauge how a student is getting on, and there are imperfections to coursework, there are clearly imperfections to exams, and an awful lot of teachery and academic debate goes into what the best way to assess someone is. But the system itself works because it's based on the course, certainly for GCSEs and A-levels.
Yeah.
We've got a database of well over 500 courses, which are the subjects and the exam boards, and broken those down into bite-sized chunks. So it's absolutely about the course and preparing the student to do as well as they possibly can by making sure that they've got great course coverage. And that's how that works. And we've looked at doing the same, and we have done the same actually for the SATs in the younger years.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And currently working, because lockdown is creating these gaps that parents in particular, I think, are really worried about. Possibly unnecessarily, possibly not. I think only time will really tell. But we're looking at whether or not you can create the same kind of benchmark, if you like, against sort of the younger years. So when you're coming out of year five, year six, year seven, what are the kinds of things that you would really have wanted your child to have learned, skills that they've been taught, in order to be able to progress? Because a lot of this knowledge is cumulative. Skills definitely are.
Yeah, and you need the foundations. And in fact, just on the news this morning, so very timely, I think they were saying studies are showing that it's the 6 and 7 year olds' education that seems to be suffering most at the moment, that gap in knowledge from not being at school, being homeschooled. I don't know why. I'm not informed enough about that, but there's definitely a massive gap in, as you say, those younger years and those foundations they should be building at that age, which then everything else is built upon. If those are missing, then what happens to their future and how they build on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a real worry. And I think it's a real worry for parents. Certainly, I'm really grateful that mine aren't that age at school, because they were unruly when they were at home. And so if they were then at home all the time, I'm just not sure. Because why wouldn't they be? I think the thing that really struck me as my children were growing up, and they are still growing up, even though the eldest is now 20, was how quickly they adapt to the environment that they're in. So my son, for example, knew really early on that he could get away with nothing. That makes me sound almost comedically strict. He could get away with less with me.
Yeah.
But he could get away with a bit more with his mum. Mm. And he could do broadly whatever he wanted with his nan. And he knew that, and he'd switch every now and again. He would test the boundaries.
Yep.
Are you still the strict one? Oh, yes, no, you are still the strict one. And then move on. But then when he went to nursery, so there I am thinking I'm the disciplinarian.
Yep.
I remember picking him up from nursery and maybe he had a dentist appointment or something like that. And I picked him up in the middle of the day. And all of these, I don't know how old they would have been, 2, 3, 4 years, were lying asleep on these little rollout mats that they had got themselves.
Yeah,
someone had got 20, 30, however many there were, children to get their own mats, to lie on these mats and to then sleep.
Like a strange baby factory.
Isn't it weird? You've got to think there's some, if it wasn't for the fact that then Jake was sat in the corner quietly eating nicely. All of these are unusual. You think, what have you done with my child? And if it is drugs, could you just leave some in your backpack? Yeah. Because they do, they just know how to adapt and change. So actually, if you're a 6-year-old and a 7-year-old, you're home and mum and dad have still got to work. Still got to do the usual things that they would do in the house. And then try to encourage a young one to learn. I think it's really, really tough. So you can see, I think, why that's such a tender age.
It is.
When so much is learning as well. But
a funny little story about the impact also mentally on these kids. And we can't always see that. I don't know if the older ones speak up, or, well, not speak up more necessarily, but certainly the younger ones seem to get on with it and seem to adapt and seem to be resilient. But then you see things like yesterday morning, my 6-year-old, who's very mature for age, very sensible, knows where the boundaries are, etc. In a moment of, I don't know what it was, frustration, confusion, just zoning out, she just got her felt pens and she drew all over the laptop screen. And I came down, because I was in a call, I came down, I thought, oh my goodness, what's happened? And she just decided that's the right time to draw pictures on the screen, which luckily are washable markers. But she knows not to do that.
Yes.
And she never does that. She doesn't draw on anything that's not a piece of paper anymore. But something in her head just went somewhere else. Yeah. And that's definitely lockdown. That's not normal behaviour for her. So who knows what's going on?
Yeah. But I think we can all, I can relate to your 6-year-old. Not that I've drawn on the screens, because obviously now I'm buying my own screens.
Yes.
Don't destroy the stuff you have to replace. But absolutely, that sense of frustration, of boredom, of needing to break from what is now a new normal routine.
Yeah.
And absolutely, and finding those kinds of ways to sort of express yourself. Mm-hmm. And what we found with the eldest is that he has regressed, definitely. Okay. Definitely regressed. So this is a rugby playing lout. he looks like a man.
Yeah.
And yet he acts like a child. It's phenomenal. So he has reverted to almost toddler like. He'll play FIFA. There are glasses of water left everywhere. Wherever he is, there's something. The dirty washing will just get dropped. And you think, we trained you out of this because we had to, because it was just ridiculous. You were meant to be at university now, and that's what we were building up.
Oh, right,
for
right.
Years, yeah. That he's at home. And so it's like, what's for dinner? You know, you're capable. You're more than capable of doing this. You could do dinner. So I'll just wait. Seriously. So I do think there is something about this sort of artificial environment of just spending so long at home that is making us all do sort of odd things.
Strange things. So then you alluded to a bit earlier that you're obviously using sort of corporate agile techniques for your new product and new business. So where has that come from? And tell me a little bit about where your journey was and how you got to founding your own business and going down the sort of education route.
So my background, the plan, and this is going to be a little ironic for a man who set up a planning business, effectively. The plan was I was going to become a lawyer and do those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So at university, and I did law, which seemed like a good start. Met my wife as she is now at university. Mm-hmm. And once we finished, we moved to the West Country, which is now where we live, because her family were sort of from this area, and mine, as much as I love them, and I do, they're not from this area. So it seemed like a really good idea. And then we thought, right, we need to be sensible, we need to pay the rent, because these are the things you have to do now that you're pretending to be a grown-up. And so I looked for a job while Michelle went to do law, and we're both law students.
Yeah.
And the idea, of course, being that once she'd qualified or got a training contract, that I'd then go back and do the LPC course, the sort of final year of study that you need before you can get your training contract to become a solicitor. So just found a job, any job. It happened to be in PR, not anything I'd ever heard of. Had to phone up someone and get a definition of what it was the night before the interview, and got the job. And so, started in public relations and this idea. And I think what was odd, even sort of at that quick eureka moment was there are so many more jobs out there than I ever realized that there were. Mm. My career days at school would have been based on, if you like being outside, be a gardener.
Yeah.
If you like children, teacher.
Yeah.
Clever, lawyer, doctor. And there wasn't
or no general business you, person.
Exactly right. Hairdresser and those kinds of things. But no one ever told you you could be a marine biologist or you could be a PR exec, to be honest.
Yeah.
Which I may sound much more aspirational than I found it at the time. But yeah, so there was this whole sort of marketing world out there. Mm-hmm. And when I was at university, I used to work on the markets in the East End. And so I'm quite a gregarious person. I like being around people and sort of like to think that I've got good powers of empathy. And so that really came through in the marketing piece. Mm-hmm. So I quite like this marketing stuff and communications. So I'm going to stick with it. And so I did. And this was also at the time that the internet age was dawning. So FreeServe was a thing. The first time you didn't have to pay for your internet browser, although you did still have to unplug the telephone to get AOL to load and all of these kinds of things, which was exciting, quite like that. So I moved into new media.
Now old media.
You're very, very old. Yeah. Defunct media.
Yeah.
It was CD-ROMs and designing PowerPoint presentations. the fun we had. And then started to look at websites and e-commerce. So my sort of, my career became marketing and it became digital and thinking about customers. I've also done some brand internal and external brand transformation, TV advertising, and all of that kind of stuff, which was really interesting. Definitely not the path that I'd intended at all, but a better path, I think, because I'm not really sure that having two lawyers in the house would have worked. I think I'm right anyway. So actually, if I was right, it would be awful. So staying in marketing seemed like the right thing to do. Unfortunately, at that point, so Jake had just been born. We were married when I was 23. Mm. Jake came along when I was 24, which
young parents.
Amongst our friends group was quite young for people at university. And so that was difficult trying to sort of juggle this. I want a career. Both of us did. So Michelle was qualified by this point and sort of working up the ladder. I had aspirations to move up within corporate life. But having a young baby was really difficult because we had no money between us. So we had loads of debt. You could, back in those days, actually even now, I think, throwing money at you if you were a law graduate. Mm. So we had enough debt, but we didn't have any income really. And we had then had a son. So it was tricky. Michelle went back to work as soon as the maternity pay dried up, and I think it became statutory sick. And it's been a few years now, obviously, since we've had to do that. I really hope that's not the situation.
Yeah.
And if it is a situation, I really hope they don't call it that anymore. Mm-hmm. But so Michelle went back to work quickly and we juggled between us. So I would do an early shift effectively and get into the office at 7 and work till 3. Very, very lucky even then to have an understanding and flexible employer.
Yeah, definitely.
It was unusual. I mean, we're talking 2000 and 2001 at this point. So parental leave was just coming in. Mm. It's still difficult to juggle that. And it's still difficult, I think, for families, even with the more flexibility that the employers tend to offer, because it's not just the physical arrangements of can I be in one place and then can I be in another place quickly afterwards. It's the emotional toll, I think, and the guilt that we inevitably feel that there's something that we read, Daily Mail mentality, or otherwise, that actually, really and truthfully, one of us should be at home looking after our little angel. And actually, it's not desirable. Neither of us were stay-at-home people. We had aspirations for ourselves, and it just wasn't practical, even if we wanted to. So we sort of juggled that, and everything was going swimmingly until I had a boss who didn't have children, and that became a problem for him, because he wanted me to be there all of the time.
Yep.
And I was happy to be there for as long as I could. But there were occasions if Michelle was doing something that I would pick up or had to pick up. And if I was doing something, Michelle, and so on. So we co-parented very, very well like this. And there was one particular occasion that I had to leave a meeting that had overrun by an hour and a half to go and get my son. It didn't go down well. He told me that I couldn't be the brand head manager, whatever it was, because of my parenting responsibilities. You don't tell that to a law graduate. So we both do that. I then bided my time, took my redundancy package as I knew it was inevitably coming along, and then started up something else. So
can you imagine if someone said that now? If someone said to a father now, or a mother, obviously,
yeah,
I'm sorry, but this job isn't for you because of your parenting responsibilities.
No, absolutely.
Imagine how that'd be taken these days, which obviously is great that we take it that way, but for it not to be a thought when it happened to you is just unbelievable, really.
But I think the absolute naivety of the man came from the fact that he was telling this to another man. It's your parenting responsibilities that are getting in the way. I don't think he would have dreamed even back then of saying that to a mum.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that I had it bad or worse or anything like that, just a statement of fact. He would not have considered saying that to a mum. He thought it was okay to say it to a dad. He was wrong. It's not. And I think the world has changed and we've moved on and all of those kinds of things. But even back then, parenting is a shared responsibility. Mm. It isn't, you are parents. It's not that the mum is the parent and the man is the provider. I mean, it's not even antiquated. It's just wrong. It doesn't work like that. Just bizarre, really. And really stressful, actually, at the time. And I didn't realise how stressful it was until I knew that I'd been made redundant. Mm. And it was like a huge weight had been lifted because I knew that I'd take them to the cleaners because it was a sex discrimination claim waiting.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So
all of this weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And I remember distinctly Jake running, because I'd obviously come home early, and then Jake running down the corridor, "Daddy, you're home. What are you there? What are you back for?" And picking him up and sort of throwing him around a bit and thinking, I haven't been this relaxed for months and that's not right. And it was a real watershed moment of thinking, I am never, ever going to put myself in a position where work is affecting my home life like that. But I'm going to make every endeavor not to.
Yeah.
So working for myself seemed like the best way out of that. How can I make sure I don't work for an employer who's unreasonable? Work for yourself. And so
you can be unreasonable towards yourself if you want to be, but that's fine.
And I am. I think I am more unreasonable to me than anybody else would be. But it was, it's sort of like the freedom. And again, I think that there are so many more opportunities now to do things, working for yourself. I mean, it's whether it's reselling products that you can, that people get online and sort of making a business out of that, which people seem to do very successfully. All kinds of things. Well, lockdown has shown us that remote working and working from home and being flexible is possible. Mm. And so you can do that, I think, without necessarily thinking of yourself as an entrepreneur. You can try to find the path that suits your family life. And I do think that's if I could go back and tell my younger self something wise and sage-like, it would absolutely be that you don't live for work. You work to live, and it's keep in mind always what that priority is. And it sounds luxurious to sort of be in a position where you go, "Oh, I don't want that high pay job, or I don't want to work for more money. I just want this." But there comes a point where you think, "Well, at what cost? If you could have the high pay job with extra pressure, but you didn't get to see the children in the nativity plays, is that a price you're willing to pay?"
For
some people, they'll say yes, and that's fine. There's no judgment. Mm. But I think the vast majority of us would say, actually, no, that's a step too far. Mm. And if you can concede, as I did when I was reflecting back at that point, okay, so there are things I'm not prepared to give up. Mm. What else am I not prepared to give up? Now it just becomes negotiation. I've sort of overcome that hard bit of accepting that I don't want to be the CEO of someone else's business, I should say. What else am I prepared to give up? And actually then starts looking at, well, if that's what I'm prepared to give up, why don't I look at it the other way around and actually what's in it for me? What do I want? sort of looking at my values, and they start saying, I'm only going to start working for people again. I'm only going to work on things that are fun. I like having fun. Life's too short not to have fun.
Life is too short. Life's too short, and your children's childhood is too short, as you've just said.
Yeah.
So you want to be around as much as you can for it. But I think it's great that you've done what you've done, and you've had the courage and the confidence to look at your values and look at what will make you truly happy and what will work for you and your family. But there's still so many of us, and I'm the same as you. I took that step to completely change. And it wasn't easy, and it's still not easy, and it's scary, and it's your own thing. And if it goes wrong, it's just you who you blame for it and all that sort of stuff. It's your own guilt you put on yourself. But there's still so many of us who just simply haven't got that confidence to say, actually, this isn't what I want to do anymore. And I don't want to work in this company which doesn't support me and my family. And I don't want to work for the employer who is telling me I can't leave to go pick up my child from nursery. So I think, and that's men more than women, tend to have that challenge to be able to speak up. So I suppose it's how do we encourage people through coaching helps, by the way. but how do we encourage people to feel like they can speak up for what they want in their lives and be true to their values? I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
So I think it's these things, and I can't pretend to be an expert on it. I can only be an expert on my own experiences, but I would see it as coming down to you need either one of two things to have happened, and one will be the seismic shift. I've just been made redundant.
Yeah.
What does that mean for me? And I think a number of people are going to be in that position.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, as a result of the pandemic and obviously things changing. So if you found yourself in that position where actually tomorrow is not going to be like it was yesterday, what can I do about it? Mm-hmm. It's a forced introspection, I think, and then you can look at it in that way. And then the other way, I think, is by a form of coaching. And if people are lucky enough to have access to a good coach, then I think that's absolutely key. Some of the best experiences I've had are by having someone help me look at what needs to change.
Yeah.
And I'm an egotistical man. Egotistical person. The man bit was actually irrelevant. But, but I am an egotist. I am supremely arrogant. And I know this about myself. These are flaws that I've come to accept. So I think I know everything anyway. But actually having someone guide me to the right questions to ask, even if I'm finding the right answers to my own questions is key. And I think we all need that sort of the mentoring type role, the coaching type role, the critical friend who can who can just have a chat. Now, that could be partner. It might be someone in a professional capacity, such as yourself. But I think that's really key. So if it's not going to be seismic, then you need to start changing that process. So it's either revolution or evolution. But I completely 100% accept that if you're in a job that you hate, but it's paying the bills and you need your bills to be paid, you sort of suck it up and you just carry on. And I think all of us have been in that. Certainly many of us will have been in that situation. But I don't think even in that situation, there's any harm in looking at what your alternatives might be.
Yeah.
And that might be when you become surprised. Actually, maybe I could start up a blog. Maybe I could start reviewing things online, looking at alternatives and sort of start to factor it in.
Yeah. And it's actually often these sort of side hustles, which I think might be a new trendy word that people are using, they start off as sort of passion project, whatever it might be. I think actually I was reading again this week, the Unmumsy Mum was on, who I follow on Instagram and various things. She started blogging, whenever it was, how many years ago it was now, just for her own sort of self, for mental health, really, just a cathartic exercise was to blog her experiences of having a young child at that point. And then someone read it and someone thought it was funny. And then someone else read it. And eventually now she's a author and very successful. Obviously we'll know who she is, very successful entrepreneur, if I want a better word. And that's just because she started doing something that she felt passionate about, and it just grew into something that's now entirely her career. So I think, as you say, you can still be in the job and earn the money and pay the bills, but just by having maybe something that takes you out of that and gives you a different focus, even if it's not potentially going to be a career change. As you say, you never know what door might open.
No, absolutely not. And so this, so the study buddy came about for exactly that. It was, there was a problem that I solved, and we are adept at solving problems, and we do it all the time. Whether that problem is, how do I stop the toothpaste cap from disappearing down the back of the sink? Oh, what about like this? Or how can I get my team to actually study for his GCSEs? We're all coming up with these kinds of things. And so I think what we also take for granted is our own inventiveness. And actually, if you've had a problem, you're probably not the only person that had that problem. If you've solved that problem, the other people who experienced the problem would love to hear about it.
Yep.
And so I do think that actually there's something in that of just sort of being a bit braver. But also so the study buddy isn't my first entrepreneurial venture. When I left my job from the redundancy, I set up a software business with two other people. And all of them have been kitchen table startups. So the idea I think that people have when you think about startups or entrepreneurial businesses and trying to do that around having a young family. So by this point, my son had been joined by my daughter. So there's 5 years between them. So we've always had a young family. While I was setting up businesses, and my wife, again, very lucky in that she's worked constantly and is a hugely successful lady. And so we've sort of been comfortable in that way. But yeah, I think it's entirely possible to do these things on a shoestring. And if you can find other people who are a bit like-minded and you can complement your skills with a hammer and someone else's skills with websites, then fantastic. And so networking, I think, is and local networks in particular, I think, are great for that kind of thing. Local chambers of commerce and LinkedIn, obviously, on a global scale, but the FSB and other people do sort of local type of networking events. I'd absolutely encourage those kinds of things, because when you meet people and you go, oh, I think like you think, and oh, you can do that. I've always wanted someone to do that. Maybe we can work together on something. And yeah, as you say, if you don't try, you'll never know.
No, you'll never know. You never know. And I think the power of local, I think, is even more important at the moment, it feels. And I know that in lockdown, lots of different sort of local neighbourhood groups popped up to support each other with shopping or just general having a chat, whatever it is. So I think the local connections have got, certainly where I live, have got a lot stronger during all this last year or so. So by getting involved in those local, like I said, chambers of commerce or business networks, I'm sure we'd be extremely welcome nowadays. It'd be extremely inclusive society to be part of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it comes back to, if you want to make a change, you need to do something about it. I think one of the favorite things that I always said when I worked in corporate, and between the software business and this one, I spent what was only meant to be a couple of months doing a consultancy project for a bank, and it became 7 years. So it's I would like to say it's a mistake, but it wasn't. It was different. But during that time, it was about identifying good questions. So we're quite quick to solve stuff, and certainly if you're used to a corporate environment, as I suspect a number of your listeners will be, that actually solving stuff is second nature. Problem, solve it. It's fine. And actually what we're not very good at is making sure that the problem that we identified was the right one. So what is the problem that you're actually trying to solve? So asking good questions is key. But also, you can't solve a problem with the same kind of thinking that created it. And taking a step back and looking at things from a different angle, asking someone else. On one level, I guess it's you're challenging your unconscious biases, but on another, it is quite literally looking at something as if it was something else trying to solve it in that way. And that's what you get from meeting and talking to other people, I think.
Absolutely. You get a different perspective, don't you? It just takes you out of yourself for a bit, which can only be a valuable thing. So what's the future of Study Buddy then? Where do you think this is going to, at the moment it's teenagers, but yeah, you're expanding to the younger audience, and something I'm definitely going to look out for my little ones if they stay at home for much longer. So where does it go next, do you think?
So the plan, and again, I say that crushingly aware of the irony, because no one had predicted COVID. So the plan was in year one, I will try, just get it out there and test the market, see if people liked it and overcome some of the challenges, because my background has always been digital or intangible, sort of financial services and that kind of thing. I've never dealt with a physical product. So questions of, how much storage space do I need and where do I get it from? Postage, how do I get these things out to people? As well as more complicated stuff, as it worked out, that I'd completely glossed over. How do you print to a magnet if your printer's made of metal? My very, very first customer, who actually came about before we'd even before I'd even built the website, actually, she took me about 3.5 hours to complete her child's GCSE bundle. So because it's all bespoke, so I can't. It's not like I can just go to a shelf and pick out
right.
maths and biology, because maths with AQA is different to maths with EdExcel. There are, I think there's probably at least a dozen different sciences that you could have. So each one is handcrafted. So 3.5 hours it took me to build the first one. I can very happily say that's not the case now. So the first year was proof that it worked. Second year then was meant to be about sort of industrializing. So how can I make that faster? And so now we've got systems in place, better databases, better printing systems and mechanisms, so that we can support a lot more students. That was when COVID hit. So we were industrialized, but not necessarily with that groundswell. So I was hoping for this sort of tipping point. So the future is still to get past that point. So the final bit of industrialization and proving that the inner workings are great, and marketing. So it's, how can you go out and tell people about this? So I know it's a great idea, because as I've already confessed, I am completely arrogant. But I also have had that validated by other people who've said, this has really helped my daughter, because she was ever so anxious. And actually it really helped her to get a handle on what was going on. And helped little Johnny, because he's a lazy little so-and-so and he just didn't want to work. And so, as I say, I've had that great feedback. And the next bit is then, so how can I take that and then reach other people and talk more about it? And then hopefully as well, we're already looking at different innovations as we respond to what's going on around us. So as I said, the younger learner sets that originally I'd never planned to do, but it seemed to be right to help families who, as I say, were juggling children and home and work. Looked at lower price point thing, summaries as well, so that we can help more students, and certainly during this time. Because the important thing for me is that it is not just for profit. So there is a social, a sort of a force for good aspect that I am really, really keen we deliver on, and that we see through. New territories, new exams. So also doing more A-levels than we were before, interested in T-levels. And then who knows where it will go from there. There could be a whole range of buddy-based enterprises to help people organise their lives.
I feel like you could be the next Jamie Oliver for education, for GCSEs, like he was to school dinners.
You can. I'm wondering now whether or not my Essex accent is coming through a lot more than I was expecting it to.
Now you've said it, no, not at all.
I should be ending on like pucker. Although, as I said, I thought I'm crushing that. That did not sound Essex.
It didn't. I should just end the podcast right there. So just before we do wrap up, and it's not because you said pucker. That's not the reason. I'm going to draw it to a close soon. I suppose, are there any final, again, as a sort of father of a teenager, so I haven't had that many parents of teenagers on the podcast necessarily, and you've been through the revision, you've been through the exams, and now he's hopefully a man, but still a child at home. What are your kind of, any sort of words of advice for people like me who are approaching those years? So my daughter's 11, so I've got a couple of years left, and then she'll be going into that phase. Any sort of, apart from drink more, any words of advice?
Okay, so not try gin more. I think that on practical levels, and I worry that I'm going to sound like I'm straying into twee and cheesy, but it's not meant like that, because actually it's learning the difference between my son and my daughter. Mm. So when Jake was little, we would tell him that he was brilliant at stuff. Oh, you're such a natural at maths. Mm. You're really good at this kind of, oh, he comes so easily to you. And what a clever boy. And so what we were doing accidentally, it seems, is giving him a fixed mindset. He knows what I don't have to try because I'm just like natural. Right. So why bother? Yeah. So you've got that on one hand, I don't need to try. And the other hand, actually, he gets the praise because he's achieved something. And why would you risk then trying something you don't think you'll achieve if you're not going to get that praise? Mm-hmm. So you don't bother to put the effort in because you believe you're natural. Yeah. And actually, you don't try something new because actually failure is a bad thing. Right. And mm-hmm. I think that then led to mm-hmm. his position at GCSEs, which was very much about, I don't really need to put the effort in because I'm doing all right. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. Whereas, of course, stuff gets harder. So yep. you need to put it in. You need to put that effort in. Whereas with Emily, she never actually had that immediate attainment. She was always really hardworking. And I remember she would say a time when she said, she'd had her school report or something, and her effort grades were always really high, and her attainment grades were about where you'd expect, which is fine. And she'd say, you're doing really well. I really love the fact you're trying so hard. It's great to see that you're enjoying school, and all of your teachers say how nice it is for you to be in the class. Not something we always had with Jake. but then she'd say, but I'm just not as clever as Jake is. Yeah. You do not need to worry about that at all because you're trying hard. And so what you can see is happening is the more you try, the better you're getting. Yeah. And the better you're getting, the more you're trying. And so that's then a growth mindset, this idea that it's not about the result, it's about the effort. And so my biggest advice is to absolutely really be conscious about the praise that we give. Yeah. And as parents, we love praise. Of course we do. Why wouldn't you? And there is something so powerful about the subtlety of you've tried really hard and I'm really impressed over look what you achieved. That's fantastic. And it's that difference because the jobs that our children will be having most likely don't exist. And I know people say that and it seems a bit weird, but actually we're chatting today over the internet, a thing that did not exist when we were your daughter's age, for example.
No, absolutely not.
So actually someone is managing this, they're writing this code. Mm. So the jobs are created and they don't exist. So you need to have an attitude towards lifelong learning, which is something that as adults we need as well. But with our young, you can foster that by sort of really, really encouraging that. And then the next thing, my second big tip is to absolutely demonstrate or be free to talk about the times when things haven't gone according to plan for you individually. Okay. So I think, as parents, we tend to want to protect our children against everything and at all odds, more so than I think our parents did, and certainly more so than grandparents did to our parents and all that kind of thing. And whatever the motivation is for that, it's what we do. We protect them. And I wish I could say I came up with it, but there's a great analogy that actually what we do as parents is we prepare the road for our children. So we go in there, we get rid of all the obstacles and we make sure there's nothing dangerous and everything else. Whereas actually what we should be doing is preparing our children for the road, making sure that they understand resilience. Yep. And while I'm on a roll firing cliched sayings at you, our children won't do as we say, but they will do what we do. And so if we can role model these behaviors of accepting, like, this is a time this went wrong. I wasn't expecting that time. I was made redundant from a job. Mm. Wow, how was that? Well, it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And I wasn't expecting it to be. Yeah. And if you can have these stories and just not be afraid to show that it's part of life, that things will go wrong and then you correct yourself and go right. Actually, our children are going to be so much more geared to that rather than presenting the always on authority figure of parently child follow, I know best, let me just take this away from you. I'll save you from yourself, which is very much what I wanted to do with Jake in the early days. And the more control you give them, the more they actually rise to that challenge, and which is an oddity because I really didn't think that Jake would. Certainly at that point, it came as a real surprise.
Yeah.
Thinking this almost Kevin and Perry-esque adolescent. He can't be left in charge of his own revision. That's not going to work. He can't even organise himself to clean his teeth every morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, that's not fair or true. But it was that kind of idea.
Yeah.
And actually, he'd never had to do it because I was always doing it, or his mum was always doing it. Give them a bit of freedom to make their own mistakes.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenally powerful.
Mm-hmm. And role modelling, I think, comes up in practically every single conversation I have with parents is... role model. They will do as you as they will do what you do.
Yeah.
They will say what you say, and you know, these little parrots absorbing everything, and this sort of comes out of their mouths. So make that positive, make that make them into independent thinkers, I suppose, isn't it? And
being able exactly
to
right.
That freedom.
Yeah. And I don't think we really see it. And even though you know it's true. So they will, as you say, parrot fashion. Then it makes me laugh every time, and I didn't realize how much I have sayings until I can hear them coming back from it.
Yeah.
So seeing my little angelic daughter going down the stairs and something, and her say, "Oh, for the love of God." Oh, that might be me. I think I might do that. So we know that they'll pick up on stuff that we say and you hear it back. But actually, I don't think we really apply that same kind of thinking to the way that we behave.
And, yes.
I don't mean like good behavior and bad behavior. I mean habits as well. And what we do, I was never any good at maths. Don't worry about it. It's actually the impact of what this means to them.
And again, our values. So whatever our values are, whatever we're living our life according to our values, that will emanate out of us in some way and it'll be absorbed by them.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So we need to, not swear. So I'm glad you said love of God, not something worse. That's a good start.
Actually, to be fair, I don't think I've ever sworn in front of my children, and I'm not up for any parenting awards. I'm really happy to admit that. I have got a "You're the best dad in the world" mug, but I'm fairly sure I bought it for myself. But yeah, not swearing in front of them was something important that I just sort of stuck to. But otherwise, off of camera, so to speak, like an absolute fisherman. So so if I can train myself to moderate my language in front of the young ones, who knows what I'm capable of doing?
Who knows what we can achieve? Well, Nathan, I think that's a great place to end, I think. So thank you so much for being on. It was I knew it would be a great conversation, and it was. So what's the best way for parents who potentially want the study buddy in their lives to help with their teenagers? What's the best way to get that, and also to get hold of you more generally?
Of course. So the website is always going to be the best place to start. And that would be, if you'll indulge me, that would be thestudybuddy.com. Okay. But also... you can find email addresses on there to get in touch, or LinkedIn and Facebook, of course, as well. We're always happy to hear from parents and just give advice. As I say, genuinely, I want to help in whatever way I possibly can. So, do find a way of getting in touch. It'd be lovely to hear.
I'm sure there are some great collaborations potential out there as well. I mean, what you do. So, perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much, Nathan. Have a lovely day and a lovely weekend.
And you, thank you very much for having me.
See you very soon. Take care. Bye.
Talking to Nathan was like chatting with an old friend, and it was so interesting to hear how his practical approach to parenting and his passion for wanting to help kids be the best they can be led him to starting up the Study Buddy, which has been a great success. Thanks for joining me on this episode, and see you next time.